Kent said, well, what do you want to talk about? And I said, well, I've been in publishing for so long, I could be here for a long time. But I thought I would just tell some stories, share some of the experiences, some of the things that I learned along the way in this business, being mentored by some of the wonderful best people I've ever worked with and met in this business. And it's so nice to be here. I actually lived out west for a while. So I lived outside of Colorado for 3 years, so I can kind of call myself a Westerner, even though I live back in Connecticut. So this is a bit of a tour of what I call Creative Edge Publishing. Before I do that, I want to tell you how I actually got into publishing. How many of you were liberal arts majors in college? Okay, so I double majored in political science and philosophy, which my father, who was an electrical engineer, to his final day, didn't ever quite understand how that worked. And I graduated from college in 1977, and it was the Jimmy Carter recession. Even though I was the first president I voted for, he put me into a recession. And I went on a record, 21 job interviews, and when the last one told me that I would be great if I had some job experience, I really got depressed, went home and said to my mom, where the heck am I going to get my first job? So being a first grade teacher and very inventive and resourceful, she called her buddy Roz Rabin. Roz called her buddy, who was a director of marketing at Prentice Hall, and said, do you have any entry-level positions in marketing? Sure enough, they did. And that's how I got my first job. So to my mom's last time I saw my mom, she and my sister and brother, the only people on the face of the earth who call me my nickname, Jimmy, so please don't start. But she said, Jimmy, don't ever forget. I said, yes, Mom. She said, Roz Rabin and I got you into publishing. And every time I was promoted or I got a new job, dutiful mother, she would send me a nice little card and say, congratulations, Jim, and don't forget. So that's Roz. Being on the creative edge is I think, particularly in publishing now, is a tough, good place to be. One of the words that I don't like that sometimes comes up when we're in ed board or publishing meetings is I'm comfortable with that. This usually comes up with sales numbers. So if you have meetings where you're in a group and one of our senior salespeople made a mistake with me in one of our meetings, and said, I'm comfortable with that number. And I just said to him, when was the last time we were comfortable in this business? And he kind of looked at me and he said, you mean I'm confident in that number? I said, that's a better word. And I think we are on the edge in this business and things have changed. When I think about what this business was like when I started in 1977, if my 22-year-old self kind of parachuted into this business now, I wouldn't recognize it. And I think it's important to, as we go through the business and we see what's happening and the trends, is to be really thoughtful about what that edge looks like for each of our different companies. One of the things just to share that I did, and did a startup actually, called Oliver White. Some of you may have heard of it. It was a small little business press. Mark, we met. It's where I first met PGW. So I was a PGW client twice in my career. So we started working, and get to this fellow in a minute, and did a book that was really remarkable. I'm going to go to this fellow. I'm going to go back. This is Larry Wilson. Everyone heard of Larry Wilson? Wilson Training, Pecos River Learning, out in this neck of the word. So we did a book with him called "Stop Selling, Start Partnering." For those of you in sales and marketing, it's probably one of the best books I've ever read or published. To get some heads nodding on consultative strategic selling. But this guy taught me a phrase that I really have taken to heart. I use it a lot in leadership development with people. But it's a real philosophy of life. It certainly was for him, and it was very successful. And this is his phrase, playing to win versus playing not to lose. And I love this for a couple of reasons, and I think it really applies to the heart of what great book publishing and great publishing is really about, and having a great life is about, frankly. The first part I like about this is play. I remember the first time my daughter was old enough to ask me what a publisher does. And I told her, I said, well, I'm in meetings and I go out on sales calls and I come up with ideas with people and we publish books and we help sell them. And I explained the whole thing to her. And she was about 8. And she paused and she thought and she looked at me and she said, Daddy, and they pay you for that? I said it's pretty cool, isn't it? Because it actually is fun. You know, when you listen to colleagues and friends you have in other walks of life, sometimes we lose perspective. I know I can and do. This business still is fun. And it still is rewarding. It still is special. It still is different and distinctive from most anything else that we can do. However, we still have to win. So this is the competitive business side of the business, where being in some of the bigger companies I've had to work for was a different discipline, a different challenge, a different opportunity for me to learn. So I think there's that side of it. Then there's the less positive, which is playing not to lose. And this is when myself and Claude included, it's sometimes we can fall into the tendency of saying, let's just do enough to get to the numbers. Let's just have a good enough year instead of really going for it. And I think it's also, this came up, I heard in How to Get to Your Number in 90 Day meeting. So I'll just confess, as an older publisher, I hate comps. Okay. So when that came along, I just said, this now becomes buying by the numbers, or what I call rearview mirror publishing, where you just say, give me another one like we just published last year, instead of give me something special that's never been done before. And all of your businesses and all the ones that I've been involved with have been sitting in a room with an editor who walks in and tells me something that I would have never thought of in 1,000 years. And that's what playing to win is. But it's not about the comps. It's not about just doing what we did last year. It's about saying, let's do something that hasn't been done before. And that was a real inspiration from Larry Wilson and the training and the development programs that actually some of my groups did with him was really remarkable. The other guy, had this other word I just want to tell you about, is quite a character. So this is John Long. How many of you have ever rock climbed? Okay. So you may know this guy. John Long was one of the original climbers. He's from the LA area. He's climbed all the major peaks, including Everest. He's a Falcon author. He's done one of the seminal best books on how to climb and rock climbing technique. I don't do this. I appreciate people who do. Talk about playing to win. I asked him, because he grew up fairly modest circumstances, how he got into this. Because LA and rock climbing, you don't quite think the two go together. So he told me about being bitten by this bug. One of his buddies took him out rock climbing once, and he couldn't get back to that cliff. He didn't have a car, so his buddy would drive him out along the freeway, drop him off on an overpass on the underside. He'd walk up the side, grab onto an I-beam, and go hand over hand across 4 lanes of traffic to the other side, turn around, and go hand over hand all the way back. And I said to him, I said, John, weren't you nervous about falling? He said, no. And I said, well, how did you do that with no fear, no trepidation? He said, Jim, I just looked straight ahead and kept moving. So he's quite a guy, 63 years old. He still climbs. And his whole thing was kind of an inspiration to me. We think about publishing in those moments where we say, you know, you get to a certain stage in your working life or a certain stage in a business where holding on is just enough, or doing what we used to do last year was just enough. And John's still a guy, still looking forward, still doing something that he's never done before. So I think it's, as we think about playing to win versus playing not to lose, and we're leading creative businesses, we need to, I think, and what I enjoy most is still keeping myself and my colleagues on their toes and saying, what's the next big thing that we want to be embracing and doing together? another thing that I just want to share that's special about being, I think, in a creative place is watching people love our books. This has happened at the Winter Outdoor Retail Show, which I have to tell you, how many of you ever have attended that in Salt Lake City? Right. It makes BEA look really modest. Because you're walking into these multi-million dollar booths, and it's all over the top, and they have free beer every day, and it's really good beer, by the way. And we were going to do a book signing. This is an author that Rick Reinhart signed, and we've been publishing for how many years, Rick? 20 years. So this is a good franchise. So this is a whole series about getting young girls outside with getting their boots muddy, having fun, and they can still be a princess at the same time. The series has sold hundreds of thousands of copies and really connects well to Falcon's kind of outdoor market position. So she was going to do the signing. Unfortunately, she was sick, so couldn't make it. So we just piled up 100 books in front of the booth. And we had young princesses from 6 to 28 come into the booth, grab a copy of that book, clutch it to their heart, and just about cry. It was one of those things to watch in terms of what this book meant for young women, for little girls, but also to see how, you know, here we are as an outdoor press, this is Falcon, we're into rock climbing and hiking, but we were melting 100 women's and girls' hearts in that booth and doing something where you can see them connect to a theme, but also a message for girls and women that you can do everything that your brothers do too. And it was just a great thing to witness, but also speaks to the power of the creative edge that we bring to our business and we need to continue to be focused on. In the creative trenches, which is sometimes what our business feels like, it sometimes feels like this to me on Monday morning when I come in and look at my project list and it's like, oh my God. And sometimes it's easy to get stuck in those trenches and to not do what this is a – you can't probably read this. This is a Norman Rockwell painting, and it has – this is, I think, meant to be in Manhattan. Everyone's looking down and walking across, you know, in front of this church, and the rector's putting up the sign of the message or the sermon for that Sunday, and it's called Lift Up Thine Eyes. And, of course, they're all doing that. Now, we all know in Manhattan that people don't really walk like this. They actually look right at you, and if you don't get out of their way, they'll just run you over. So, but I think one of our primary jobs, if we're a publisher or we're in a leadership position or a solo performer, is to lift our eyes up, encourage people to say, yeah, there's a lot to do this week. It's a lot to do today. We have a lot. We have to get out the door. We have to make our sales number. We have to ship these books. We have to deal with the problem author. Of course, we never have those, right? We have to do all of that stuff, but it's important to remember the story I just said about a bunch of young women and little girls with their hearts being melted by a book we just published. And I think to be able to have the creative language, one of the things that I was taught by somebody early on in my career when I first started managing was most of us can't recall more than 3 things, which is true because we have too many other things going on in our minds. And to really lead and to have a message that inspires people is to ask people to think in 3s. So I always have 3 strategies and 3 themes, and I have the same phrase in the same language. And every month I meet with the whole team and I repeat it. And then I tell them what we're doing and how we're accomplishing those 3 things. And one of the phrases I'll give you, one of our strategies for this year is in my company is known as the Dunkin' Donut contest. So, or initiative back east on New England, if you drive around, every other corner is a Dunkin' Donuts. We're not as healthy as you are out here. So, it's true. So the DD is not really for Dunkin' Donuts. It's for dense dollars. So the strategy here is we need to maximize our front list revenue per title rather than growing by publishing additional front list titles. So it's a major initiative. Everyone recalls the Dunkin' Donuts strategy. And all the editors know that what they're signing and what we're publishing and marketing and sales know that that's one of the most important things we need to be accomplishing as a press is to be publishing better books, not more books, and books that will have traction, that will impact the market in a more significant way in year one, and will also backlist and go on to have a happy long life. So that's a really key aspect of how we communicate and how I try to lift up people's eyes, to think broadly, to think strategically, but also to be inspired about how their work truly makes a real difference. The other thing is how we need to continually reframe our mindsets and how we think about the overall business. As Rick mentioned, I've moved around a tad bit in my career. Some people are smiling. So this is the 8th company that I've worked for. And one of the things that I've learned in that whole process is how to reframe just going from one business to the next. So as you can imagine, going from Time Inc. to Globe, from a $4.5 billion company to one that's a lot smaller than that, required me to sit back and think differently about how I was going to be managing and where I think the business was really going to be going. So one of the things I do as an actual exercise, and it's not just when I change companies, but I do this every year for myself and encourage my staff to do it too, is to literally unpack the box of our thinking and experience and say, what still works? What still applies? What doesn't? And what do I have to be doing differently in the coming year so to be successful? So this is either managing, leading, communicating, how we're making publishing decisions, how we're assessing markets, how we partner going into the marketplace, because I think things are moving so quickly that it's really important to do these assessments. I know we do this all the time on the fly in each of our own businesses, but I think it's important to have a discipline of sitting down once a year and saying, let's start over. It's also a really good thing to do in terms of like doing things such as zero-based meetings, where you just say, let's kill all the meetings. And everyone said, oh, no more meetings. Said, no, we're just going to kill them for right now. And then we'll start over and figure out which ones are really meaningful. Because publishing, I mean, Rick mentioned this, we all like to talk. I mean, we're all talkers. But that tends to generate a lot of conversation, which tends to generate a lot of meetings. And that can get in the way of getting our real work done sometimes. So this is important, I think, in terms of framing up. The other thing that I think, depending on the size of your business and if you're in multiple markets, is to really think about our businesses as portfolio management. And to look at the different product lines, the different markets, and to be really objective about potential, about growth potential, and about where you see the revenue growing in those different distinct markets. So it's something that I had to do at time. And, you know, I think it's also, as we think about how markets are changing, it really helps us to not be overly emotionally attached to the books we truly love or to the markets we love, but to be objective about choices that we make, investments that we make in the business, and to have objective criteria in terms of how you actually do that on a consistent basis. I'm going to talk a little bit about brands. One of the things that has been interesting in my line of work is I've spent 18 years of my career working for magazine publishing companies as a book publisher. How many of you had that experience? Anybody? So the best way I can describe it to people who spent their whole life in book publishing is when you're the book publisher in a place like Time Inc., I was like the ugly second cousin who they locked up in the attic, and then they let me down afterwards after the dinner for the scraps that were left over at the table. So, because I would used to go in and, you know, I was, the book business was Time Inc. Books, which I thought was pretty cool. And we did all the bookazines and all special issues. So we did 600 products a year. It was a pretty big division. And I thought it was pretty big deal until I would go in and sit down with the editor of People magazine, who proceeded to tell me that, you know, People magazine was generating $900 million in revenue that year. And he's the guy who does the pre-Oscar thing. He's really cool. So this is the other side benefit. I'll tell you the side benefits of working for Time Inc. as an aside. Free Super Bowl tickets. I got all the dish on all the celebrities. My wife had got all of the royal baby pictures before anyone else did, which she thought was pretty cool. And because I'm a Mets fan, I get to sit in the owner's box for every year, of course, except for the year when they got to the World Series, and watch them lose for free. So those are the side benefits. But I think the thing about brands that it really taught me is that they are powerful. Even Taunton, when I was there, had and still has great brands in fine cooking and fine woodworking, et cetera. And I think sometimes in trade publishing, we don't think about brands and the discipline of publishing and marketing as brands. So obviously, if you have great author franchises, we already have that. We already have brands. But sometimes you also can have brand partnerships. My company now has those with companies like Orvis and L.L. Bean and Backpacker, and they're really effective. And brands, I think, give you an automatic definition and position in the marketplace. They give you a megaphone from a marketing point of view. It's essentially free marketing, the way to think about it. But they also, I think, give you an impact and a real expansion beyond your normal market reach. I mean, one of my favorite stories from Time was the first sales call I went in at Barnes & Noble, and it was the whole merchandising group from BNN. So those of you who have done that meeting, I know Larry has, that's not a pushover group. We were walking in pitching this cross-merchandising promotion with Time Inc. Books and Time Inc. Magazine, so you would think this was going to be easy. So I walk in, and the executive VP of merchandising for Barnes & Noble sits down, stares at me across the table, his whole team, and I've got my team there, and he just said, "I want to tell you guys this is not happening." Don't you love sales calls like that? That's like, you know, so I just, but to those of you who will get to know me, I'm kind of a stubborn cuss. So I said, all right, put that aside. I said, so how many of you currently read a Time magazine, one of our magazines? Every hand in the room went up. I said, tell me about your favorite magazine. Let's go around the table. So it was real simple, Sports Illustrated. It was People, Fortune, Southern Living, Cooking Light. You know, we kept going. So this went on for about 20 minutes. Meanwhile, the EVP down at the end, who I know really well, is seething because he knows exactly what I'm doing. So we get to the end of this whole round robin going around the table. And I said, you are the customers we're going to reach here. You love these brands. You read these magazines every day. Your customers at Barnes & Noble are the same people. So doesn't it make sense for us to have this position in the front of the store with our magazines and books? And they all said, sure. And we had a PowerPoint presentation, and we just threw it out and walked out the door. I got a call later in the day from the EVP at Barnes & Noble Merchandising. I can't repeat in public what he said to me. But at the end of it, he said, you know, Jim, I think this is going to work. And it actually did. So brands, the other thing, if you don't have a brand, you can invent one. At Taunton, we invented brands that we published, like the Not So Big House. We invented Four Bros by Pros, which was a building series for pros. Huge design series called the Idea Book Series. So those are all things that can help you franchise your publishing program and have great market recognition. And these are some of the brands you can see. Obviously, this is Time. This is a great brand story. I tell it briefly. This was a book. Life Magazine is a dead brand. So Life Magazine stopped publishing many years ago. It still generates $10 million a year in revenue for Time Inc. Okay. This book was on the 50th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. Everyone kind of knows the connection here. Dick Stolle, who was the editor, went down, got the Zapruder film, bought it for Time Inc., sequestered the Oswald family. This is a great story. And he wrote this book, so I had a chance to meet him and talk to him. Sequestered the Oswald family until the FBI and CIA came after him and said, you've got to take us to the family, otherwise we're going to abscond the film. So he brought them to the Oswald family. So this is the first-person story of how Life covered the Kennedy assassination. And it was a $50 book. It sold 90,000 copies in 3 months. But it speaks to American history, but the power that a brand and a tragic story in American history has, but also what it's like to work with some people who were part of history as well. I think we're going to just go to this piece here for the sake of time and talk a little bit about playing the advantage of not so big publishing. So since I kind of feel like, you know, the song Both Sides Now here. So since I've been in these big, huge companies, you know, I truly have enjoyed every job I had, and I really enjoyed being there. But my heart has always been, I'm just a book guy. And when you're running a division of Time Inc., you don't get to be a book guy. You get to be a finance guy. So that's one of the reasons why I took this job, is I wanted to come back to my roots, because I was an editor for many years too. And the advantage we have of being small to mid-sized publishers is that we're not big. And those companies are tremendous, but they don't have the same heart and soul that we do. They don't have the creative verve on the same level. They also have the lack the distinct advantage we have of being immersed in our markets as enthusiast-driven category specialist publishers, and they also can't move as fast as we can. So those are the advantages we have. I always tell my team if I think they're not moving fast enough, that we're deliberating too much, or that we're not close enough to our market, or we should have known about a trend, that those are our inherent advantages of being a mid-sized press. And it's really important that in my business, I think for all of our businesses, that those are the advantages that we play to our very best. Because the fellows in New York have advantages that way outweigh us in many other areas, but they don't have this. And they don't have the people sitting in this room. So I think it's key to think about when we're thinking about growth. It's the advantage that this brand has, Falcon. How many of you know Falcon Guides? Yeah. It's been publishing for over 35 years out of, started in Montana. It was acquired by Globe about 16 or 17 years ago, I think, something like that. Yeah. A little bit longer, Rick's telling me. But it's one of those brands when I go out and travel that people have a strong affinity with that they know really well. But even with all of us publishing for all these years, we did a research study, and this is where data is becoming more important every day. And I think, you know, I hear a lot of tension between going with our intuitive creative guts, which is really important. Excuse me, but also looking at what data can tell us. So anyone guess where most of Falcon Guides are sold by region? National parks. So the two biggest regions, 70% of our sales, I'll give you a little proprietary information. If there's any competitors in the room, go for it. 70% of our sales are in the West, in the Pacific Northwest and Northern California. So we lined up outdoor participation rates looking at sports with our sales, with the competition, and said, all right, 80% of the rest of the country we're not publishing for after 35 years. I think there's an opportunity there. Somebody came up to me after that meeting and they said, so that's what publishers do. I said, yeah, we're occasionally good for something, you know. So it was an editor, of course. But I think this is where being immersed in our markets and really understanding the trends and what's going to drive our business is really important. So I'll just close on this one note. You may have guessed this is someone who's related to me. So my wife and I are actually at the stage where we're actually grandparents. And this is my granddaughter, Emma Childs. So Emma's 4 months old. She was born on September 26th of last year. And she was named after her fifth-time great-grandmother, who was a school teacher in upstate New York in Geneseo. And she loves Shakespeare. She loved literature. Not this girl. My great-grandmother did. And this girl will, but she's too young for it. And the reason why I know my four times great grandmother loved Shakespeare is I have her books. And all the Shakespeare plays, all the plays from Shakespeare are all annotated. So she read them all. And we have all of her letters as well. So, you know, when I think about the legacy of publishing, which is one of the, I think, the most important things that physical books leave behind, is a legacy of how each of these books changed our thinking, our lives, how they inspired us, how they brought us into new relationships. It's important to look at this little girl who's 4 months old, who already has her first books. I can't imagine where they came from. But, you know, I think is at the end of this century is going to be a grandmother reading to her grandchildren. And the books that, you know, she'll be sharing are the books that come from us. So I think it's a thing to always keep in mind when we're looking at being on the creative edge in publishing and when we're in the trenches on Monday and when we're trying to make our numbers for the month or cash flow doesn't look so hot or whatever it is that's the challenge of the moment. It's over the many years that I've done this, it's always good to pause and to remember the Emma Childs of our business and the people, the literally in this room, the tens of thousands, if not millions of people who have read our books over our creative publishing lifetimes and the difference that those books have made in their lives. So it's an important thing to think about as much as just be focused on the business. But frankly, it's really nice just to look at Emma. and it's also nice to look forward to sitting down with this girl and reading her some stories as well. So that's what I just wanted to share with you. Thanks so much for letting me spend a few minutes and share some of the stories and experiences from close to 40 years in a business that I still truly love. Thank you.